It is Tuesday, February 16th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, as President Obama and the leaders of 10 Southeast Asian nations wrap up a first-of-its-kind summit in California, we'll hear from a VOA correspondent about why hundreds of people went to the venue to protest the meeting. Another of our correspondents reflects on the life of former UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali, who has passed away at the age of 93. And we'll talk about why it was such a successful night at the annual Grammy Music Awards for American pop icon Taylor Swift. It's all ahead on International Edition. U.S. President Obama and the leaders of the 10-member ASEAN bloc focused on developing innovation and entrepreneurship in Southeast Asia on the first day of a two-day summit that ends on Tuesday. Hundreds of protesters rallied outside the Sunnylands Estate in California, where the meeting is being hosted, saying that they want human rights at the top of the agenda. Earlier, I spoke to our correspondent in California, Mike O'Sullivan, who was at the protests, and I asked him to describe what they were like.
Well, there were several hundred people gathered at an intersection as close as they could get to the actual site because of the police blocking off the immediate area. But it was in a section of desert on the side of the road, hundreds of protesters, and they were immigrant groups from Vietnam and Thailand, Cambodia and Laos, protesting human rights issues in those specific countries, and wanting those to come up in the course of the discussions between President Obama and the leaders of those nations, and also some labor and other groups complaining about a regional Asia-Pacific trade partnership, the TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that four of the 10 ASEAN nations are involved in. It's a U.S.-led trade group. A free trade group, and a lot of the labor groups are complaining that it will lead to a loss of U.S. jobs and other problems for U.S. workers.
Were there any indications that the complaints and demands of these protesters were actually heard by those attending the summit?
Well, I'm not sure. There were various caravans going in and buses, and you're not quite sure who was in them. I suspect that most of the leaders did not see much of the protest, if anything of the protest, but that these issues are coming up in private discussions. The president, of course, is very well aware of them and has talked about trade discussions as being a forum for bringing up these human rights issues. The protesters are worried that the issues are not being presented forcefully enough in the interests of furthering open trade. But the administration says it's well aware of the human rights issues in Southeast Asia, and the fact that many of these countries, several of them at least, are led by non-democratic governments. So that is coming up in the internal discussions, even if the protests are not very visible from the inside of the meeting.
Well, thank you very much to our correspondent in California, Mike O'Sullivan, for that report.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, next we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, with us in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So what are some of the ASEAN leaders saying online about this summit?
Many leaders are posting their arrival to the United States almost real-time. Noynoy Aquino is the Philippines president, and he tweeted a picture of him and President Obama on Twitter. His handle is @NoynoyAquino. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak also tweeted about his arrival in Bahasa Melayu. When translated, his tweet reads like this: I attended the summit retreat session of the U.S. ASEAN leaders. His full name is Muhammad Najib Tun Razak, but his handle is simply Najib Razak.
Okay, can you tell us about any other leaders who are also tweeting about the ASEAN summit?
Mm-hmm. Lee Hsien Loong is the Prime Minister of Singapore and tweets in English. His handle is his full name, and the Prime Minister's office manages the account, but the tweets by Lee are signed LHL. And Tuesday's tweet is signed with that initial. It reads like this: Happy to meet President Obama again today to build on ASEAN-U.S. strategic partnership.
So this Singaporean leader has been in the States for a couple of days now, right? What has he been up to?
Well, he was visiting San Francisco to meet with IT industry insiders, and the list of the people he met should give you an idea of the focus that the country is having. He met with Elon Musk of Tesla, Google CEO Sundar Pichai, and its executive chairman, Eric Schmidt, and he also met with Apple CEO Tim Cook.
A lot of high rollers there. Well, turning back to the U.S., what has the U.S. mission to ASEAN been tweeting about the summit, which ends today?
It tweeted a link to its page on President Obama's remarks at the opening session of the summit. And if you're interested, you can check out the account at U.S. Mission to ASEAN with the number 2 in the Arabic number. And just like yesterday, the best hashtag to use to keep posted on the event is hashtag US-ASEAN2016. Back to you.
Thanks so much, G. And you can follow G on Twitter at the handle GAbbyLee. And you can also follow me as well. I am at Michael_Lippin. And of course, please follow our show. It is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A computer made in Sweden is changing the lives of children in Argentina with neurological diseases. A computer called Toby enables users to communicate with their eye movements. Sheila Levy's 7-year-old son, Ian, has chronic encephalitis, which affects his speech and motor skills.
What has changed with Ian is that he can play on his own, turn the television on, share a moment with his brothers.
Toby's eye-tracking technology also allows disabled children like Ian to participate in standard school classes, says therapist Natalia Ibarra.
One very important thing is the smile on children's faces when they manage to use the device and the independence that it gives them.
At about $14,000, Toby is an expensive device, but the price has been dropping. And organizations like Ian Levy's school in Buenos Aires can use them for more than one student. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Former UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has died at the age of 93. Boutros-Ghali, a veteran Egyptian diplomat who helped to forge his country's peace agreement with Israel, was the UN's 6th Secretary General, serving from 1992 to 1996. Earlier, my colleague Susan Yaki spoke to our correspondent here in D.C., Mohamed El-Shenawi, and asked Mohamed to reflect on Boutros-Ghali's life.
I was lucky to meet with him several times. I met him first time when I was a student in Cairo University, and he was then a prominent professor of political science at the university. Then I interviewed him for The Voice of America when he was Egyptian foreign minister, and in both encounters he was very impressive and very warm personality. The third time I saw him personally was at the White House when I was covering the Camp David Accords signing, and Egyptian President Sadat, Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel, and President Jimmy Carter signed the 1979 treaty, ending a 31 state of war between Egypt and Israel, which is a breakthrough in the history of the Middle East conflict. On the professional side, Boutros-Ghali was a very shrewd diplomat, and his reputation enabled him to be the first Arab to serve as a UN chief. He took office in 1992 at a time of increasing influence for the United Nations, and also during one of its most difficult times with crises in Somalia, Rwanda, the Middle East, and former Yugoslavia, and he served 1 5-year term. While he had said earlier that he will not seek a second term as a Secretary General, he ran again. And late in 1996, Security Council voted to give him another term. But U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, in her last days as an American delegate to the Security Council, casted a decisive veto as one of the 5 permanent council members, and Boutros-Ghali thus became the only Secretary General to be denied a second term.
Well, Mohamed, what about his personal upbringing in Egypt?
Well, he was born on November 14, 1922, into a Coptic Christian family in Cairo. He was married to a Jewish French lady, and was educated at Cairo University and then in Paris, where he established a long life connection with France. He studied international relations at Columbia University in New York and became Egypt's foreign minister in 1977. After leaving the UN, Boutros Ghali served from 1998 to 2002 as a secretary general of the Franconi, a group of French-speaking nations, and in 2004 he was named the president of Egypt's new Human Rights Council, a body created then by Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak amid U.S. pressure on Arab nations for some sort of democratic reform.
And that was VOA correspondent Mohamed Al-Shanawi speaking with International Edition's Susan Yaki. The World Health Organization says countries dealing with outbreaks of the mosquito-borne Zika virus should consider using controversial methods to fight its spread. One of those methods uses genetically modified mosquitoes to stop Zika-infected mosquitoes from breeding. That effort to develop those sterile male mosquitoes is being spearheaded by a British company named Oxitec. My colleague Ira Melman spoke to Oxitec CEO Hayden Parry and asked him how effective the mosquito project has been.
Remarkably so, actually. I mean, we've been pioneering this for the last few years, so we've actually got field trial data, you know, using this outdoors in urban environments since 2009. In every trial we've done, and by trial, what I actually mean is we're releasing our mosquitoes in an urban environment. In every trial we've done, we've reduced the Aedes aegypti mosquito population by over 90% in about 6 months.
So by 90%, that is quite amazing. But as you know, there is opposition. Environmentalists have cautioned against the use of GMO mosquitoes, saying the long-term effects of killing off an entire insect population is unknown. About 150,000 people recently signed a petition against the use of the GMO mosquito. What do you say to these people?
Well, I think it's very important to understand exactly what we do. Now, people have a conception of genetic modification, and it largely comes from the use of genetically modified crops. And the normal perception is that if you're going to use something that's genetically modified, I'll put that in inverted commas, that you're putting a new gene or you're putting something into the environment that stays there and will spread and replicate. And that indeed is what most people think when you talk to them about this. But actually, with our system, it's the complete opposite. Every single one of our mosquitoes that we release will die in a few days. If they mate a female, then the offspring will die in a few days. Nothing stays in the environment. Nothing spreads. So actually, what you can do is you can control a mosquito population in a town without actually having any long-term effects in terms of the ecosystem, because you're not spreading a gene. You're not... and nothing is staying in the environment. That's absolutely key. The other thing I would mention here is that we actually use a color marker, which is quite unique, actually, which means that we can actually see, in effect, where our insects go. We can see where they're having an effect. We can predict how many we need to release. It's a system of constant monitoring and metrics and understanding the effect we're actually having. And I would contrast that to what people do at the moment, which is using insecticides, where you fog or spray, where not only do you affect all insect life, including beneficials, but you actually have no real idea what the effect you're having. You're just putting chemicals into the environment and hope that's having an effect. With our approach, it's very precise, very well monitored.
Well, you've been listening to Oxitec CEO Hayden Parry in conversation with International Edition's Ira Melman. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. The United States has given its first approval to an American company to build a plant in Cuba to assemble small tractors for private sale to Cuban farmers. That company will be the first U.S. manufacturer to begin operations in Cuba since the 1959 Cuban Revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power. Ted Henken is an American author and Cuba watcher. He told my colleague Victor Beatty that he doesn't expect this development to lead to a wave of U.S. business activity in Cuba.
There's still a general complaint among many Cuba watchers, especially Cubans on the island, that Obama has done a lot, whereas Raul Castro has done little in terms of taking advantage of the open door and the open hand. So this is significant in that it is a good example of a real business deal, and the fact that one of the two men who are behind the company is a Cuban-American is also significant in that it'll be symbolic as a reconciliation between Cuba and the diaspora.
Do you expect this to become a domino effect with a more rapid unfolding of American business opportunities?
I don't really think it will be a domino effect quite yet, because the U.S. regulations are still quite restrictive, despite the fact that Obama has tried to use his executive powers to open things up. For example, this factory that will produce tractors is only going to be selling those tractors to the cooperative and private sector and farming. And so that makes the impact limited, because that is all that can be done right now with the embargo still in place. We won't really see anything like a domino effect until, of course, the embargo is lifted. The Obama administration has called for that, but Congress has yet to approve that, and it's unlikely that that will happen until Obama's actually no longer the president.
Why is that?
Well, because the U.S. embargo in 1996 was shifted from the purview and the control of the president, the executive branch, to Congress. And so Congress in both houses has Republican majorities. Now, there are increasing numbers of Republicans who are critical of our policy toward Cuba and think that we should be using our assets, our values, our capitalism to, you know, increase prosperity. But that's still a bit of a political risk to take that stance as a Republican, especially given that the prominent Cuban-American Republicans are staunchly in favor of continuing the embargo and see any lessening of the sanctions as a reward to the Cuban government.
As far as the Cuban leadership is concerned, are you seeing a reluctance on their part to open Cuba up?
They don't want to be seen as doing anything that is seen as a concession to a U.S. demand. The Cuban government is saying we're making changes based on our own interests and our own priorities to preserve the revolution.
And that was author and Cuba watcher Ted Henken speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Well, now for some entertainment news. It was a very big night at the annual Grammy Awards for American pop star Taylor Swift. For more on that, here is my colleague Susan Yaki and VOA Music's Larry London.
Border Crossing's Larry London has joined us, and I know that's always going to be a fun time because Larry's a fun kind of guy. And today he tells me he wants to focus on Taylor Swift, wonderful, talented, good-looking woman. Yeah, singer.
Exactly. And I was going to focus on Captain Sue, but I've decided instead.
Our listeners don't know who that is. When I was in college, I was called Captain Sue.
We're going to talk about Taylor, who, in my opinion, was one of the better opening numbers for the Grammy. She sang her brand new single, which is Out of the Woods, which is the sixth release from her 1989 album. And she looked great. She had this sparkly one-piece bodysuit on, and a short bob hair. She looked great. She really looked great. The confetti was flying, and it was a great opening to the show. And speaking of the 1989 album, that's the story, because the biggest award of the night, obviously, that everyone waits to find out, is the album of the year. And Taylor made history this year when she got it for the second time.
I wanted to ask you something, because you know this stuff. I read that the Grammys are kind of old because she wins so much. And they thought it was old stuff that she won, and they thought that the rap singer should have won.
Kendrick Lamar? Well, you know, there's different schools, different camps. People believe different things, and there will always be, you know, who should have won the Super Bowl.
Right.
You'll always get that, the factions of fans. And I don't think it's, you know, gotten boring or stale or predictable. She only got one Grammy. And so I think she deserved it. The 1989 album produced six hits. No other album has produced that many hits. And as I mentioned, the last time she did this was 2010. She was only 20 years old at the time. Her album Fearless won Album of the Year. She's the only female in Grammy history to do that, to win two Album of the Year Grammy Awards. The last time it was done, it was 1975. Stevie Wonder did it. So that's how rare it is, and that's how special this particular event was for Taylor Swift. And she gave a great acceptance speech.
Is she going to be like the Cher of her generation?
I don't know, because Taylor Swift is known not so much as a singer, although she is a singer. She's known as a songwriter. I think Cher is not really known as a songwriter.
No, no, no.
But Taylor Swift kind of writes great songs, and a lot of her great songs draw on personal events and experiences, including relationships. A lot of the songs talk about past relationships and leave us all guessing, who was that one about?
I've heard she's a little sensitive about that, though.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is. As a matter of fact, you know, she doesn't want to talk about her personal life too much. She's sensitive on a variety of subjects. You may remember at the MTV Awards in 2009, Kanye West grabbed the microphone out of her hand she was accepting an award, and he said Beyonce had the video of the year. Well, Kanye West has a new song out called Famous that pokes fun of Taylor Swift, and he says he made Taylor Swift famous.
Oh.
And when she got her Best Album Grammy, she said, I want to just say for women all around the world and for artists all around the world, own it. It's yours. You deserve it. She said, I deserve this. No one else gets credit for this but me.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Larry. And let's listen to her song, Blank Space.
Yes, this song was nominated for a Song of the Year, so let's listen.
That's Taylor Swift playing us out on International Edition. My thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer Jan Crafton. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Catch you later.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The 22nd Amendment to the United States Constitution, ratified in 1951, states that no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of the president more than once. The amendment resolved an issue that Americans had debated since the founding of the Republic. Should there be a limit on the number of terms any individual can serve as President of the United States? The U.S. Constitution, as adopted in 1789, set no term limits for the office of the President. But many Americans feared that a popular leader, if continually reelected, might become corrupt or oppressive. Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, was troubled by the Constitution's omission of term limits. The feature I dislike, he wrote, and greatly dislike, is the abandonment in every instance of the necessity of rotation in office, and most particularly in the case of the president. America's first president, George Washington, chose to limit his time in office to 2 terms. A precedent followed until the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt to a 3rd term in 1940 and a 4th term in 1944. His death in 1945, early in his 4th term, reignited the debate about the ability of persons continually reelected to the presidency to serve effectively. As President Barack Obama noted in his address at the African Union in July, South Africa's Nelson Mandela and America's George Washington forged a lasting legacy, not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.